This call is being recorded. If you do not wish to be recorded, please disconnect at this time.
Hello, everyone. This is the HKM Employment Attorneys National Coronavirus Roundtable. This call will be recorded, but I think the way we've done it is that only the presenters, which I'm going to introduce in a little bit, will be able to talk. And everybody else is muted. And we do that because in the past, it's just we had a lot of feedback and it was sort of difficult kind of to hear everyone. So we are going to record this. In addition, you don't need to take clear notes if you don't want to, because we're going to post a recording and a transcript of this roundtable onto our website. And that's hkm.com/coronavirus. In addition, I wanted to start off by saying, you know, we are going to focus today primarily on national law. We are licensed to practice law. We have members of our firm licensed to practice law in some states, but not all states. And therefore, we are providing this service simply as an informational service for you, give you sort of general guidelines regarding our understanding of the law at the time. If you have any specific questions, we, of course, ask that you contact a specific attorney in your jurisdiction. Finally, I wanted to say, you know, we're not going to take verbal questions, but at the end we will allow some time to provide written questions. And a way to provide written questions to us is to email us at coronavirus@hkm.com. Again, that's coronavirus@hkm.com. Please wait till the end, and then we'll try to answer your specific question without revealing your employer and without revealing kind of anything that would hopefully disclose kind of who you are. So why don't we get started? Again, my name is Dan Kalish. I am an attorney in the Seattle, Washington HKM office. We have Rachel Emmons, who is in Seattle also. Rachel, can you quickly introduce yourself?
Hello, everyone. Rachel Emmons. Thanks for being here today.
Great. And we have Shifa Al-Khatib. She is the managing partner of the Phoenix, Arizona office. Shifa?
Hi, everyone. My name is Shifa Al-Khatib. I'm looking forward to presenting today.
Great. And we have Cody Reinberg, who's the managing partner of the St. Louis office. Cody?
Hey, guys. Happy to be here.
Great. And the way we're going to do this is I'm going to start by giving a general overview of the federal legislation. Then we are going to talk about, Rachel's going to talk about some safe and healthy issues in the workplace. Shifa then will talk about kind of essential businesses and whether or not employees have to attend work and what circumstances do they have to attend work. And then finally, Cody will end with talking about kind of what to do about wages, unemployment, those types of issues. So, why don't I start? You know, what has happened in the last, and I'm going to talk about some of the federal legislation. When the coronavirus pandemic first hit, a lot of the focus was on state and local laws in terms of what employers could do or what employees could do. But now sort of two particular recent acts of legislation have sort of changed that. And now really kind of a lot of people have been looking to federal law. The first one, this was passed in late March. It took effect on April 1st. It was called the Families First Coronavirus Response Act. And the reason why that's important is that this is a federal law. It applies to any employer who has less than 500 employees. So, you know, if your company has more than 500 employees, this would not apply. But if you work for a company with less than 500 employees, then what essentially this statute does is it requires your employer to give you 12 weeks of partially paid leave if you have a child who is home from school, or if you have a child and your healthcare provider can't come and assist your child anymore. When I say partially paid, you will get two-thirds of your pay, and that is up to, I believe, about $200 a week. So they don't pay all of it, but they will pay sort of a portion of your wages, and then you would be able to get your job when you come back. In addition, what it does is it also allows for paid sick leave for anyone. And this is, again, for companies who have less than 500 employees. And essentially, you would get up to 2 weeks of paid leave. And this would be fully paid leave, up to $500 a week. And this would be for any issue, whether or not you have coronavirus-type symptoms, whether or not you're caring for someone with coronavirus-type symptoms. So it's we would hope that companies would already be providing this, but to the extent they aren't and you have a child home from school or you're feeling symptoms, you are entitled to sort of you are legally entitled to take some leave. You're entitled to get paid for that leave, and you're entitled then to come back to your job exactly as it was. That was sort of the first one. The second statute that is important is something called the CARES Act. The CARES Act is passed about 2 weeks after that, somewhere around the middle of April. And what this did was primarily significantly expand unemployment. And we're going to talk a little bit about this later as well. But basically what it did was that anyone who – it did three things. Number one is anyone who is on unemployment will be able to get an additional $600 per week until July 31st, 2020. So it doesn't matter if your normal benefits is 20 weeks, or excuse me, $200 or $400, you'd get up to additional $600 per week. That does expire on July 31st. That's number one. The second thing it did is it allowed independent contractors to get unemployment benefits. Before, independent workers and gig workers really weren't able to get unemployment, but now they can. If an independent contractor has either a loss of business or a reduction of business because of the coronavirus pandemic, then they may be eligible for unemployment. The third thing that it did is it expanded the unemployment benefits that you would normally get. In almost all states, you are allowed to get unemployment benefits for 26 weeks. This adds another 13 weeks onto that. So now you'll be able to get unemployment benefits up to 39 weeks. Again, the $600 benefit runs out at the end of July, but you will be able to get your normal unemployment benefits up to 39 weeks. A lot of people have been contacting us and asking us what they should do about unemployment. Part of the problem with this from our perspective is that every state is a little bit different, and every state is in charge of enforcing and enacting and regulating the unemployment procedure. So one of the things that we sort of have been advising people is if you are in doubt about whether or not you think you're entitled to it, just apply. It's a little unclear how strict the unemployment offices are going to be or whether or not they're going to sort of have some flexibility and relaxation in some of their standards. The one thing we would recommend is that when you do apply, just be as honest as you can. As long as you are honest with the unemployment office, they're going to make their decision and kind of go from there. So those are the really two primary federal pieces of legislation. And again, if you want more information about this, you can go to our website, which is hcam.com/coronavirus. And with that, I think I will pass it on to Rachel Emmons. Again, Rachel is an attorney in our Seattle office, and she will be talking about some of the issues relating to safety and health procedures in the workplace.
Thanks, Dan. Again, Rachel Emmons out of our Seattle office. As Dan mentioned, you know, we are providing this as sort of a general guideline for folks. And so, you know, if you have specific questions that are state specific, we definitely recommend that you reach out to an attorney in your jurisdiction. So one of the other things I wanted to go over just initially is that you're probably going to hear us talk a lot about documentation. And what we're referring to in that is that it's a really good idea to put in writing wherever possible any requests that you're making, any complaints that you're raising, anything about your fears, your concerns, anything like that, because if you do end up consulting with an attorney at some point, that's going to be one of the first questions you're going to get asked is, you know, what documentation you have. So when you hear any of us talking about documentation, just keep that in mind. So the first question that I want to go over is one that we get a lot, which is, what if I do not feel safe going to work? And, you know, that's obviously a legitimate question and a legitimate concern for a lot of people. But unfortunately, it really depends largely on whether you work for, you know, the different terms of critical business, an essential business, or you're deemed an essential worker. And so that should be the starting point for any inquiry you make for whether or not you have to go to work if you don't feel safe. And so one of the things that we would encourage you to do is to look at any shelter in place or mandate orders that are being issued across the country. And also be keep in mind that those orders are rapidly changing. They've been changing for the last few months. And so make sure that you're looking at the most current edition of that mandate. Oftentimes you'll see a start and end date. It's really a good idea to make sure that you are consulting whether that is an active mandate or not, because certain things are opening, certain things are closing. And, you know, generally speaking, if you're deemed a non-essential worker or you work for a non-essential business, you can't go to work based on a lot of those orders. So, so if your employer doesn't know that, you know, you might need to make them aware. And honestly, those shelter-in-place orders are not entirely clear in all cases. We get a lot of questions from folks about whether they're essential or not. And when you are trying to determine that, it's best to talk to your employer, let your employer know that you have some concerns or that you are concerned that you're not an essential worker. So those are a good starting point. If another question that we get a lot of is, okay, what if I am immune compromised or I have an underlying condition or a disability that makes me particularly susceptible to COVID-19. You have a few options. The first is you can, you know, just have an informal conversation with your employer and see if there's any options available to you. But sometimes you're going to have to take it a step further and formally request a reasonable accommodation. You would do that through human resources or management. And generally what that means is that you are proposing some ideas to your employer to help find out, you know, whether there is anything that you can do to protect yourself in the workplace while you're continuing your job. So for instance, a reasonable accommodation in this setting might be working from home or an ability to wear a mask, even if it's not something that's required, and maybe a schedule change so that you are working at a different time of day than any of your coworkers, maybe a leave of absence. Keep in mind that it's very likely you would be requested to provide a doctor's note or some kind of documentation showing that there's a connection between your underlying condition, your disability, and the request that you're making. And so just keep that in mind and keep in mind that it's an interactive process. It's not a situation where there's going to be a one-size-fits-all necessarily. So make sure that you're having ongoing conversations that you're documenting with your employer. One other piece to keep in mind is that if you make these requests and you find yourself suddenly retaliated against, demoted, terminated, we would recommend that you'd have an attorney in your jurisdiction evaluate your circumstances, just because there may be more to it than they can't accommodate you. Again, if you have a serious medical condition and you meet some of the other criteria, but you say you don't fall under the Families First Act, you may still qualify for FMLA or some kind of state leave. So if FMLA is available to you, if you have more than 50 employees in a 75-mile radius and you've been employed for at least a year, so you could request FMLA paperwork from HR, have it filled out by your doctor, and that would be unpaid leave. But that might be another option for you if you're feeling unsafe at work or you are susceptible based on a serious health condition that you have already that you are concerned would be exacerbated by COVID. Again, there's also state leave. Some are paid, some are unpaid. And then, like Dan was talking about, you know, with the families first, you may be eligible for that emergency leave, particularly if you've been advised to self-quarantine. You'll probably want to show your doctor's note to your employer. And then, again, continue to document every communication that you have in writing wherever possible. Another question we've received about insurance. Insurance coverage is going to vary employer to employer. It's going to vary in terms of when your employment ends, if there's continuation of coverage or not. And so some of that's contractual, some of that's under COBRA. So I would suggest that you look at what kind of employment agreement you have, and also if you have a severance package, what is contemplated by that package. Another question we've been getting a lot is, what if I have or live with a relative who's immune compromised or has an underlying condition or disability that makes that person susceptible to COVID? This is a really unsatisfying answer to give people, but generally an employer is not required to give you an accommodation for a relative or someone that you live with. There's just a lot fewer protections. However, if that person is a spouse, a parent, a child who has a serious health condition that would be otherwise covered by the FMLA, you could, again, apply for FMLA leave to take time to be with that person. Again, that's 50 or more employees in a 75-mile radius, and you have to have worked for at least a year. Another option is if it's a child, again, you may be qualified for that Families First Coronavirus Relief Response Act if you have that person under continued treatment or you have to care for them personally. So, but again, not a very satisfying answer. Now, another question we're getting is, what if I'm a caregiver for someone who has COVID or similar symptoms? It's a good idea to notify your employer. Take that 80 hours of sick leave if that person is subject to quarantine. Again, that 80 hours is under the Families First Care Response Act, Coronavirus Response Act. And if your employer is too large, again, FMLA may be an option for you as well. But again, make sure you're submitting these in writing. Make sure you have a doctor's certification as well to make the process run more smoothly. There's also, you know, state leave laws, sick and paid leaves that cover your family members as well. So make sure you're looking into those, and also some city ordinance as well. So make sure you're looking into those as well. Another question we've been getting is, do I have to go to work if I have COVID or if I have COVID-like symptoms? This is another not entirely satisfying answer to give, but it's really not entirely clear legally, but it seems unlikely that if you refuse to go to work because you have symptoms or you've been diagnosed, that it would be illegal to fire you for trying to protect yourself and others from this very virulent disease. So if you're and also if you're diagnosed with COVID, you're likely subject to a quarantine order. So best practice, notify your employer, request sick leave pay under the Families First. If you're seeking a diagnosis, you still can get those 80 hours. And remember that there is somewhat of an incentive for your employer. They're getting a tax credit, so this isn't, you shouldn't be feeling guilty for taking this time to protect yourself and your family and your coworkers and your community. And again, if you don't fall under the category of the Families First, you may still qualify for FMLA, though that's going to be unpaid leave. And again, you can look at sick leave, leave policies that your employer provides, things like that. And keep in mind that the FMLA has clearly articulated anti-retaliation rights and anti-interference rights. It's not quite so clear under the Families First Act, so just keep that in mind and continue to document wherever you can. And if you have accrued sick leave or vacation leave in a company policy, you can utilize those as well. Another question is, can I be fired for having COVID-19? This is another situation where It's a gray area. If you're not following safety rules, you could legally be fired, likely. If you're violating a mandate or you're hiding this illness, those are likely reasons that could land you a termination. If you have been trying to follow safety procedures, you've reported to your employer that you have COVID and that you're self-quarantining and that you're taking all the precautions, and you still get fired, I would suggest that you talk to an attorney in your jurisdiction to help you navigate any potential claims that you might have. If you are staying home because of COVID, or COVID-like symptoms, make sure that you are documenting that and letting your employer know. One other category of workers, the independent contractor, self-employed people, just a note, you likely aren't going to qualify for the Families First or the FMLA or sick leave, but you should look into whether you can get some tax relief for those folks. I'm going to shift topics to talk about safety. So PPE, personal protective equipment, whether you're entitled to that largely depends on your specific jurisdiction and your industry. If you have concerns that you're not being provided the proper PPE or what you believe would be the proper PPE, whether it's gloves or a mask, or whatever the case may be, you can first informally report your concerns to HR management and encourage them to try to do things better for the safety and health of the workplace, your customers, your clients, the public. And if you have a concern, again, because of your medical condition, and you think that PPE would assist you in staying well, you can go through that reasonable accommodation process that I mentioned earlier. We've obviously been getting a lot of calls from healthcare workers, so I want to address that quickly as well. Before COVID, healthcare workers could potentially be fired for refusing to work without PPE, unless it's part of some licensing standards or disability accommodation or something like of that nature. It's less clear since COVID because there's more OSHA guidelines, there's more guidelines generally, but it's more likely now that you would be protected for refusing to work without PPE because this is, like I said earlier, a very virulent disease, easily spreadable, but it may not be. So if you experience some kind of retaliation for seeking to protect your safety or your employer's not obeying social distancing or PPE, it's probably a good idea to contact a lawyer in your jurisdiction and walk through that with them. But make sure you're also communicating with your employer and documenting if you think that not wearing the PPE violates OSHA or CDC regulations or board procedures or anything like that, and that it's that you think it's important to protect your coworkers, the public, your patients, things like that. Generally speaking, with PPE, there's some different places that you can check. Check out your state and local ordinances, your state boards, like a cosmetology board has certain guidelines, for instance. OSHA has some guidelines. There's also a state equivalent of OSHA that has guidelines. So it's important to look at those guidelines, but recognize that those guidelines are just that. They're not laws, they're guidelines. There are some mechanisms to report to OSHA or some kind of equivalent if your employer is not complying. But OSHA itself has a non-retaliation provision, but it's a very, very short window. So if you get retaliated against for filing an OSHA complaint or some state equivalent, know that it's usually a very short window of time to do that. With OSHA, I believe it's 30 days. Another option, if your state has issued an order and your employer is not following it, you can report to your state attorney general. Make sure you're documenting all of these things. Additionally, there may be situations where the National Labor Relations Board may be able to help. For instance, if you were acting in concert with other employees, trying to help other employees, and you're fired or retaliated against, you should contact the National Labor Relations Board as well. And again, that's a short statute of limitations. I believe that's 6 months as well. Another safety question we've been getting is, what if there's a confirmed case of COVID-19 at my work? What rights do I have? Now, you have to be informed by your employer if your employer knows that you were in contact with a person who's tested positive, but they don't. They can't tell you who that person is because of privacy protections. So, you know, they may instruct you that you've been exposed and to self-quarantine, but they, you know, they don't need to, and they can't tell you who that person was. If you have concerned about someone in the workplace, maybe you don't know if you've been around this person or exposed some way, you may want to encourage your employer to take additional precautions. So, for instance, you know, maybe you request that everyone self-quarantine for a few weeks or work from home, things like that. Another option, if you are concerned about a person who is potentially exposing you at work, you can take vacation, you could take leave, but likely you'd have to be following your company policy if you're going to take vacation or PTO or anything like that. If it's bad enough, you know, again, report to OSHA, the Attorney General, because under OSHA and state equivalents, you have a right to a safe workplace, but there's no specific COVID-related protections, at least that I'm aware of at this time. And note that if OSHA is being violated, it's not necessarily a something that you're going to receive some monetary compensation from. It's more likely a fine that might be assessed against your employer. So just something to know. We've been getting questions about whether a person can be tested for COVID or asked for medical records or have their temperature taken. Yes, generally, and within reason. There has to be a specific reason for an employer to be able to ask you a medical question or to inquire into whether you have COVID or require that you get tested or have your temperature. But under the new EEOC guidelines, they can require temperature checks or take other precautions because COVID is essentially what's called a direct threat. A direct threat means that that it can directly harm other people. So as long as it's a job-related and consistent with business necessity, there can be some inquiries or medical examinations that would otherwise not be okay. They can ask you why you're missing work and keep you home if you're sick to prevent others from being sick, but there still are confidentiality requirements. I think that concludes everything that I wanted to say. So I hope this has been helpful, and I'll turn it over to my next colleague.
Thank you much, Rachel. That was super informative. Shifa, why don't you go ahead?
Great. Thanks for that great overview, Rachel. So I'm going to be discussing attendance in essential businesses, and you may find that some of the information overlaps, but we want to make sure that we're answering everybody's questions. One of the common questions we've received is what constitutes an essential businesses. Basically, those are businesses that are allowed to stay open notwithstanding an order by your local government. There are a number of the orders across the country, and as Rachel mentioned earlier, they are modified on a weekly and sometimes daily basis. So I would ask that you check your local government website to see what those orders are. Typically, your state governor would have signed an executive order outlining this, and those are quite vague and open to different interpretations and not always enforced consistently, unfortunately. One thing to know, especially now, is that with essential businesses, a lot of these orders have expired, and some states are slowly opening or completely open. So if a business can stay open, there may be some limitations. And those limitations include social distancing rules, how many people can be at work at one time, how many people can be in a specific room at one time, and so you'll, again, want to check your local city and county regulations. A question we've received is, what if you do not feel comfortable going into work when your employer opens? We would suggest you taking your earned either sick or PTO leave and call your local attorney general's office to inquire about your rights. But what happens if you're fired for refusing to attend work for a business that is lawfully open? You may have legal recourse depending on the specific facts of your state. However, if you refuse to come into work, when you are required to come into work, it's likely the employer can fire you for not attending work as requested. But that comes with some exceptions. That's only if you don't fall under a legally protected category, such as a disability, or if you're not protected under the CARES Act. Rachel and Dan both mentioned the Family First CARES Act, which provides you with paid and unpaid leave. So we would strongly suggest you consulting with an employment attorney in your jurisdiction if you are fired because of that reason. Another issue with that is you may actually not be eligible for unemployment if you are terminated because you decided not to come into work, and when I'm done, Cody will cover that. A question we've received is, do employees have a legal right to work from home? Generally, no, but it may be a reasonable accommodation under the Americans with Disabilities Act if the disability prevents you from performing your job on site and you have the ability to work from home through your company. If your company allows employees to work from home but just will not allow you to work from home, they may be violating federal law. But again, as Rachel mentioned, I would make sure to put all your requests in writing. At this point, we are seeing more and more companies that typically wouldn't have allowed employees to work from home pre-coronavirus actually allowing employees to work from home now. So where it may not have been an option prior to the pandemic, it's definitely an option now. And so I would make sure to document your request in writing. And if you are denied that reasonable accommodation, again, I would seek legal advice in your jurisdiction. I know Rachel mentioned a ton of different safety guidelines, and one of those great resources is OSHA.gov. It's OSHA.gov. A lot of businesses are opening now, and many people are concerned for their safety, rightfully so. And so there is guidance on there about what the employer should be doing to keep employees safe at work. So I would really suggest everyone going to that website. I think Rachel covered most of the compulsory attendance issues and whether or not you're required to go to work, so I won't repeat those. And we can answer questions at the end, like Dan mentioned. So with that being said, I am going to turn it over to Cody to discuss unemployment.
Thanks, Shifa. And just to kind of reiterate what everyone said here, you know, we're offering this service. We want to give some guidance. We want to give some general standards of which we're familiar. I run the St. Louis office, and I practice a lot out of St. Louis and Chicago, so I'm familiar with Illinois and Missouri, mostly Illinois and Missouri. The thing with unemployment benefits is it's state-specific. So you're going to want to check your state's guidelines and qualifications. That said, we've seen, you know, we practice all over the country in our office, there are a lot of general standards, general things that we look for and we can give some guidance on when it comes to unemployment. Generally speaking, right, the standard for unemployment benefits is that you lost your job through no fault of your own, okay? So whether you were laid off, you were furloughed, or you were terminated and you weren't terminated for misconduct, right, then you're entitled to unemployment benefits. The way you're not entitled to unemployment benefits, generally speaking, is that you were terminated for misconduct, as I said before, or you left the job voluntarily without good cause. That really brings us to the question. my business, but I'm not comfortable going into work. Well, that's a right that you have, okay? And it may be a very reasonable right and a very reasonable opinion, and you may fall into certain protections. But if you don't, you need to be a little leery of just not showing up to work, because in most cases, just not showing up to work would be misconduct, okay? Or not showing up to work saying, I'm resigning, I don't feel comfortable going into the office anymore, I'm resigning. Well, that would be voluntarily leaving your job, and chances are it wouldn't be good cause if that was plain and simple what you did. Now, on the other hand, and I think Rachel and Shifa have explained this wonderfully, what you need to do is be interactive with your employer. So what I mean by that is, if you go...
Oh, hey, Cody, this is Dan Kalish. I think we lost you a little bit. So let me sort of chime in here. Again, my name is Dan Kalish, and I think one of the things that Cody was saying is that you want to be sort of interactive sort of with your employer, and sort of I think to basically cut it down is you are generally entitled to employment. If you get terminated Now, the one main exception of that is if you get terminated for misconduct. And then, sort of generally speaking, you won't be entitled to unemployment benefits. Cody, can you hear us now?
Okay. Can you hear me?
Yeah, sorry, we can hear you now. Did you want to proceed? We kind of cut off a little bit.
Yeah, my apologies, guys. My service isn't the greatest in my office right now.
Right.
What I was saying, and I think, Dan, you may have hit it, is if you're fearful of going to work, you need to work with your employer. If they're not sanitizing, if they're not offering PPE, if they're not social distancing, right, and you've brought that up to them, you've made it known to your employer that this is inappropriate, it's unacceptable, and it's unsafe. Well, and then they continue to not do it. I think you'd have a likely opportunity to still collect unemployment should you choose to resign. I can't guarantee that, but I think you'd be much better off resigning had you tried to rectify the situation than otherwise. Okay? So, my point is, don't just not go into work. Don't just say I'm not comfortable, because then it's probably going to be seen as misconduct or a resignation without good cause. One of the things Dan mentioned that the federal law did do, and this applies to all the states, so it's not just state specific, is we extended, and by we I mean the federal government, extended benefits to people who normally wouldn't qualify. And that's gig workers, self-employed, independent contractors. So the good thing for those individuals is that now they're eligible for unemployment benefits in their state. Otherwise, they wouldn't have been. And so this is a good expansion of unemployment. One thing that is we've seen in Illinois and Missouri, at least, is generally speaking, when it comes to unemployment, there's what's called a waiting period. So you lose your job and you apply for unemployment benefits, and then you have to wait 1 to 2 to 3 weeks. Well, the idea, at least in Illinois and Missouri, and I believe other states, is that they're waiving these waiting periods so we can get benefits in the hands of recipients sooner rather than later. Now, again, I don't know if that applies to your specific state, but you should research online. There are a lot of good resources for unemployment within your state. And the Missouri Department of Employment Security, the Illinois Department of Employment Security are working day and night, trust me, to get out resources to the public. It's taking long. We can't necessarily blame them for that because of the influx of applications we've seen. But be diligent, be persevere, and keep checking. And certainly if you can't get through on the phone or online to apply, I know we've seen some, again, persevere. You've got to maintain that. You've got to keep in mind. Again, Dan also noted that the 26 weeks, which is in Illinois and Missouri, used to be the standard. The federal government extended that for 13 weeks. We've got the additional $600 up until July 31st. And again, your individual states will be implementing that. And again, what Dan said, I can't echo enough. When in doubt, you should apply, right? If you lost hours, if you're an independent contractor, if you're a gig worker, you should apply, okay? And be truthful. You don't need to make things up on your application that you otherwise wouldn't. Be truthful and apply. And the only thing they can say is no. And if they say no for the right reason, that's one thing. If they mess up and say no for the wrong reason, then you can contact a lawyer in your local area. Unfortunately, it's unlikely that you'd be entitled to benefits simply because you had a reduction in wages, right? You're keeping the same hours, but your job says, listen, we've got to cut everyone's wages because the demand for business is down, we're operating at a loss, et cetera. Right? If your hourly rate gets decreased, you're likely not going to be eligible for benefits. And on the other token, if you have a job or you are off a job, and simply because of this additional package, you're going to make much less money working than you otherwise would if you're not working, that's not an excuse. You need to take that job. Unemployment benefits are exactly that. They're for individuals who, through no fault of their own, have lost their job. They're for individuals who are still in the job market actively seeking work. So if you can find work, just because you're not going to make $1,000 a week or around there, doesn't mean you shouldn't take it and stay on unemployment benefits. That's not the meaning for them. So you're going to need to take that job, certainly in my opinion. One question that we're often asked is, I was laid off, and it was through a mass layoff, and as a result of this layoff, my employer offered me some severance, right? Severance is some transition money, and you're typically going to have to sign a release to claims and some other paperwork, but how does that affect my unemployment rights? And generally speaking, it doesn't. You can take that severance. So if your employer was kind enough or you were fortunate enough to get a severance to transition during this time or keep you on your feet for a while, you can still apply for unemployment benefits. Another question is, are unemployment benefits taxed? And the answer to that is yes, they are. For instance, in Illinois, Missouri, you can elect, do you want to have those taxes taken out at the time the unemployment benefits are distributed to you, or do you want to wait till later? That's not a question I can answer for you. There are very, very few tax questions I can answer for you, but it's a question that you should think about, and if you need to work with an accountant, work with an accountant. Lastly, one thing that I want to note that kind of dovetails off of unemployment, and this is for the independent contractor, the gig worker, the self-employed, okay? The federal government, and you've probably heard about this, we're on, the second or third iteration, it's called the PPP loan, and that's the Paycheck Protection Plan, all right? And what this is it's a loan that you would apply for at your local bank. I say local bank, it doesn't have to be local. It can be a larger bank or whoever you bank with, but we've found that individuals are having much more success with these loan applications at smaller or more regional banks. And what that is it's a loan that you apply for at the bank, and you will receive up to 2.5 times your income, okay, for 8 weeks. And now, I know I said this is a loan because it is. You apply at the bank, it's through the SBA, but the government has noted, and there are various regulations that you should work with your bank to understand, that if 75% of this is paid as, quote, wages, which in the event you're an independent contractor doing, that's very likely going to be the case, the entire balance of the loan will be forgiven. So it actually operates as a grant. You don't have to pay the money back. It is a very, very good program. A lot of people have received these benefits. They've paid out billions and billions and billions of dollars. Now, the coffers are inevitably going to dry up, as they have already. We're hoping to get some more added, but it's a program you should look out for if you're an independent contractor, self-employed, or gig worker. and you should talk to your local bank about this. You know, it's a situation where if you're an independent contractor, you should, you know, speak with a financial advisor or sit down on your own. What would benefit you more, getting this PPP loan, continuing to operate, or if you, you know, you can't operate, well, then potentially unemployment. Again, we're seeing a lot of federal legislation. It, for us lawyers, this is a unique time because we certainly like to look at precedent. We like to look at how these laws have been applied, how these laws have been ruled on by the courts. And this is not a situation where we can do that. So we're doing our best to, you know, evaluate and analyze the current guidance, the current regulations, and the current law, and give our opinions on what we think will happen. I venture to say that there's going to be a lot of litigation following this, whether it be for retaliation or misuse of funds here in the next couple of years. So we'll get some clarity, but, you know, hindsight's 20/20. That said, again, check out the resources that we offer on our website. Check out the resources that your state or city offer. And if there's any questions, we're happy to help. And I'm that concludes my
thank you, Cody. I appreciate it. So that concludes our sort of formal presentation. We are now here and available to answer any questions that you have. And the way to ask a question is to email us. We're going to stay on for about 5 or 10 more minutes. Send us an email at coronavirus@hkm.com. That's coronavirus@hkm.com. And we will try to answer it to the best of our abilities. And again, that's something we haven't addressed or come up, and we will stay on the line for about 5-10 minutes. Of course, people can still stay on and listen to the questions and answers, or they can hop off with whatever they prefer. But again, thank you so much for attending this, and please, everyone, stay safe. Okay, again, if anyone has any questions, you could write us at coronavirus@hkm.com. That's the email, and we will be monitoring that. We are monitoring it right now. See if anyone has any questions. We'll give it a few more minutes. Okay, what, one question that we got was that somebody was on – so one question we have is that somebody is has qualified for FMLA. Traditional FMLA provides for 12 weeks of unpaid leave. And then the question here is, can that person – does a CARE Act override FMLA? And the answer is yes in that regard, is that if you are out because of coronavirus-type symptoms or something, or been asked to quarantine, you can look at the list on our website. But if, yes, if you are taking 12 weeks of unpaid leave and you, however, fall under the 80 hours of paid sick leave required, and absolutely, you can get paid for at least 2 of the 12 weeks that you're taking leave. So I think the short answer to the question is yes, the CARES Act does override FMLA in that regard. So another question we have is kind of when you can get unemployment benefits if you're considered what's called underemployed. So the basic idea is that most states are allowing people to get unemployment benefits if they either are unemployed or they are partially unemployed. So if you have lost either one of several jobs that you had, number one, if you have reduced hours or if you have reduced pay, apply for unemployment benefits. Just be honest with the unemployment office of what you're doing, but a lot of states are in fact providing something called underemployment or not. Even if you haven't suffered an entire job loss, absolutely apply for unemployment benefits and you may in fact be able to get that. And if you do get any benefit at all, then you're also going to be able to get the extra $600 on top of that until July 31st. Okay. Hold on a second. Just read this question here. So one person is calling in and asking about a situation they have with their sort of self-employed, and they often work on a retainer. In this circumstance, I mean, you're going to have to, I mean, unfortunately, what's problematic about the situation is that this is the first time that sort of independent contractors or self-employed people or gig workers have been able in many respects to get unemployment benefits. And a lot of states don't quite understand the rules. So if the state is not quite understanding the rules, and I would continue to contact them, continue to ask questions. I know that's difficult to do, but I would suggest that. Second, you know, for this particular person, if they're sort of a consultant and some of their work has dried up, then they should be applying for a PPP loan. You're not able to get, it's my understanding, you're not able to get both a PPP loan and unemployment benefits, but a PPP loan can provide, in many situations, significantly more money. So to the extent if there is a consultant who works on a retainer and that person is not getting nearly as much work as before, or that person should also apply for a PPP loan, and they can do that through a bank. So that sort of responds to all the questions we've got so far. I'm going to just give it a few more minutes, or a few more moments, just to make sure any last questions come in, and then we'll kind of end the session. So one question we got is that somebody apparently was having some technical difficulties when I was able to get into work, and then they got terminated as a result. In this particular case, you know, I think it's sort of hard to specifically say it, but if somebody is having technical difficulties and can't get into a particular meeting, I know of no law that protects that employee. It sounds incredibly unfair. It sounds incredibly silly what the employer did, but I don't see any law that would protect that employee in that particular circumstance. That being said, that employee, I think, would probably be entitled to unemployment benefits. So they could apply for that. But I think I would try to reach out again just to the employer, try to reason with the employer and just emphasize that there are technical difficulties. But I don't think there's any law that necessarily protects person in that circumstance. So another person asked back, you know, if they are having FMLA, can they receive then unemployment benefits after the 2 weeks of the CARES Act expires? I don't believe so. It's my understanding that you can't be both on FMLA leave and get unemployment benefits because you are getting, the simple reason is because you're kind of saying you're unable to work for those 12 weeks. That being said, what I would think about doing if I was that person is again, I don't think there's any harm in applying as long as you are completely upfront with the employment office and say that, look, I'm on FMLA for this long. I've received my 2 weeks of the CARES Act pay. Can I get benefits? So hold on a sec. So one of the issues is that, you know, somebody else has asked back sort of saying the first time they've heard that they can't receive both a PPP loan, these are for gig workers and independent contractors, both a PPP loan and unemployment. You can't get it at the same time. Now, that being said, is it possible that you could get a PPP loan and then maybe after the 8 weeks that you have to spend it, then get unemployment? That might be possible. But it's our understanding that you cannot at the exact same time be both getting a PPP loan and unemployment benefits. Whether or not you can get unemployment benefits after the 8 week period of the PPP loan expires, so you get the money, you have 8 weeks to spend it, that I simply don't know. And I'm not sure they provided guidance on that particular issue. So with that, I think we'll conclude. You know, it's almost 12 p.m. Pacific, 3 p.m. Eastern time. But thank you all again for coming on and listening. And again, we will post both this audio and a transcript to our website, which is hkm.com/coronavirus. Thank you all very much for attending.